Cabernet tends to be the sort of Errol Flynn of the grape varieties.
The most expensive beer in history.
People will turn around to me and say, oh, I'm just making gin while I wait for my whiskey to get ready.
Because wine is an adventure.
Conventional winemakers who just condemn all natural wine as faulty.
The prestigious title of Sake Samurai.
Looking at whiskey in more of an artful culinary way.
They kind of look at it as a novelty more than anything. The guy from the rock bands is making wine.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine, and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. That boutique whiskey company is a multi-award-winning independent bottler established in 2012. The company bottles single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons, and more from right across the globe, distinctively packaged with eye-catching illustrations that are inspired in some way by the story behind the liquid. In this opening episode of Season 9 of the Drinks Adventures podcast, we introduce you to Boutique's head of whiskey, Sam Simmons, and global brand ambassador, Dave Worthington. The occasion? Well, their first ever Australia series is launching globally on April 23, 2021. It features 8 whiskies sourced from across the country, starting with Victorian distilleries Starwood and Bakery Hill, both of which you already know from this podcast, as well as Killara and Belgrove in Tasmania, Blackgate and Riverbourne in New South Wales, and Tin Shed and Florio in South Australia. You can find everything else you need to know about the whiskies on the Drinks Adventures website, drinksadventures.com.au, and I'll link directly to the article in the show notes. This interview is the second half of a podcast exchange with Dave and Sam. I chatted with them a few weeks ago on their show, Uncorked Whiskey Sessions, which you should definitely check out and subscribe to. But today, it's me asking the questions. Like, how did Dave, an engineer who began his working life as a shipbuilder, find his way into whiskey?
Okay, well, I'm a geek. You look back through my history and everything I've done has been full on geekiness, you know, that motorbikes. I didn't need to do what I did with motorbikes, but I had a whole load of motorbikes and know my way backwards through a motorbike. I always wanted a chop shop when I was young. I wanted to build motorbikes, custom motorbikes. That's what I wanted to do. And I went into engineering straight away, but went into shipbuilding because I grew up on the South Coast at that time. And shipbuilding was huge in this late 70s, early 80s. And that's where I started. And then I went on to yacht building in the Far East. And my sales manager at the company introduced me to whiskey. And one bottle changed my life. And all of a sudden I thought, man, this is just like nectar. I need to know more about this. And then all of a sudden there was like, oh, geek, change in direction. Let's look at whiskey.
And Sam, judging from your accent, you haven't always been in the UK.
Wow. Astute observation, and you're also being cautious. But if you look to my LinkedIn, you won't make the Canada America mistake. I'm from Canada, from Toronto, and yes, I moved to the UK in 2002. And until then, whiskey wasn't really anything to me. Whiskey was something you would ask for a whiskey and ginger ale, maybe, and that would be Canadian whiskey mixed. You know, a few times I think when I played music, I had people after a gig say, oh, great gig, man, great show or whatever. And then here's a shot. And it would sometimes be bourbon, which you could recognize. Sometimes it'd be scotch because it was medicinal, it was peaty something. But either way, I wasn't nosing it. I wasn't taking my time with it, saying, oh, what's the fermentation time? And how about the swan neck? What angle are those at? It was just alcohol, as Dave said. But then I became, in Edinburgh, in Scotland, I became enamored with the stories and the people, and I built a network of friends, and there was this whole whiskey community, which was awesome. I started a blog called Dr. Whiskey, I think in 2007, I think I started it. And it doesn't sound that long ago, but there weren't a lot of English language whiskey blogs. I mean, there was Malt Maniacs, and there was Serge Valentin, and there was the Scotch blog in the US, but there weren't tons. So because of that, I became very visible. I mean, I would do a review of something, and review is probably not the right word, but I would write about some whiskey with some diatribe attached to it. And if someone then would Google a distillery name, I'd come up. So it became very visible. And I think, yeah, William Grant was looking for an ambassador in the US. And my wife and I thought, an opportunity to work in New York City and live in the States, that sounds cool. Let's do it. So I did that for a couple of years. And then I was invited back to the UK to be the global ambassador. So that was a 10-year, or I think 9-year, 9-month stint.
So, Sam, I think the other day when we were chatting, you were telling me a bit about the origins of independent bottlers. And, you know, we have had on the podcast before Tim Duckett from Heartwood, and he told us a bit about independent bottling.
Independent bottlers are those people that are not a distillery, but they purchase mature or maturing whiskey from distilleries and release it under their own label. The difference between my company and those companies is that we actually source the new make spirit from distilleries in Australia and New Zealand and put it into barrels we choose, and then we do the maturation.
What are the origins of independent bottling in Scotland, and where does Boutique fit into that?
Okay, yeah, I mean, Tim, I think, looks at it the right way and sort of looks to Scotland as the inspiration of this. But it's important to remember that this idea of independent bottling kind of was happening in other countries in some way or another. And it's not dissimilar to supermarkets of the UK and then the world having own label brands, this concept of sort of inventing an own label salad dressing or whatever, you know, Tesco's Finest or whatever it might be. That tradition existed in wine and tea and other imported exotic goods, and of course whiskey in you know, grocers across the UK. And that's really where independent bottling starts. It's where these grocers had a product. People would come in with their own flagons and have them filled up and great. And next time they'd come in to get more, it tasted totally different and they were frustrated by that. So these independent bottlers started to either choosing to celebrate that, or they became the big blending houses of the industry that many names we still know today. So it's kind of a cool history, but it really starts modestly as just green grocers. And you look at things like Gordon MacPhail, that still is really a exotic food shop, a delicatessen that does independent bottlings. And then so to your point about Tim's approach with Australian distilleries and buying at Newmake, that is a cool thing. And that really is what the Indies did, or that's the tradition that developed, I suppose, in some of the independent bottles we still know of today, where they would get, I mentioned MacPhail's already, but there would be contracts between MacPhail's and say Strathisla or Macallan, and they'd say, yeah, we will take 1,000 liters from you a year or whatever the figure is at birth into our own wood and store it ourselves in Scotland to adhere to the rules, and we will agree to never bottle it until it's 3 years old and blah, blah, blah. Well, as you know, anyone who bottled Macallan at Newmake is a pretty lucky person these days, and you probably still recognize their names.
It's a global tradition, isn't it? I mean, it wasn't just happening, you know, in the 1850s or the 1800s in Scotland. It was happening in the States as well. You know, these farmers would be selling their spirit to the grocer's store for provisions. There was, you know, no cash involved. Spirit whiskey was currency. I think the first brand in the US was Old Forester back in the 1870s. And Old Forester was bottled by an independent bottler. It wasn't from the distillery. Old Forester started as a release by an independent bottler.
So when Boutique started, there would have been a lot of other independent bottlers around in Scotland. It was still very much a common market practice at the time.
I think when Boutique started, it was a little bit smaller. I think we launched our first 4 releases in September the 12th, 2012. 4 releases, a Macallan, an Ardbeg, so 2 of the probably the most collectible single malts of Scotland, and 2 closed distilleries, so a Port Ellen and a Caledonic. That's how it all started. In the early 2000s, it was a bit bigger. There was a glut of whiskey, the whiskey och, and there was a few independent bottlers that came up and disappeared. There was a few bad bottlings, you know, that showed the distillery in a bad light. And so distilleries shut the doors to a lot of independent bottlers, so you couldn't buy whiskey from the distilleries direct. William Grant & Sons stopped selling single malt to anybody else. Whatever went out the door to the brokers went out as blended or teaspooned malts. And so when Boutique Whiskey came on the scene, it wasn't easy at all, to be honest. It was just really through the contacts, the network that we'd built up, or that the directors had built up as being in business for a little while, allowed us to get a hold of some of these casks. And when we started, it was really quite small. The batches were very, very small. It's only since we've been around and won lots of awards and, you know, people realize that we're here to stay, that those doors from traditional distilleries and new distillers have opened up.
Tell me about the packaging, the labels of Bootiki. It's very unique in the world of Scotch whiskey. Who kind of conceived that and who's the artist? Because I actually love the artwork. It's brilliant.
Yeah, one artist has been on board right from the start. She's a friend of the business. She's a friend, a very good friend of the marketing director at the time. The story is that I actually met on a booze cruise on Loch Lomond. The company was looking for an artist. Emily Chappell is her name. She lives in Glasgow. She's a Mancunian. She's a freelance illustrator. And she's definitely in our heads now because for a long time, we send her a brief and I look at some of these briefs that are sent her. Nowadays, the briefs are much, much stronger of what we're looking for. But we send her a brief and she comes back within a very, very short period of time of a pencil sketch. So it's all hand-drawn. And she sends that back and we make a few adjustments and then it comes back in colour within. And she goes through colour phases. She's in our head. The labels all tell stories, sometimes are very loose, sometimes they're in jokes, sometimes they're sort of historical references. There's little cryptic clues in there, certainly for some of the distilleries we're not allowed to name. There are really easily findable clues. Sometimes there's lots of cryptic clues and red herrings thrown in to throw people off the track. And sometimes there's no clues in there at all and people just read into it.
This part's really interesting. So how often is it that the distillery doesn't want to be known? I would have thought if they didn't want to be known, they wouldn't really want you to be putting hints on the label.
Yeah, there's some family-owned distilleries. Glenfarclas, for example, family-owned distillery. They will bottle whiskey for anyone. You can go and buy a cask, talk to them, buy a cask off of them, and they will bottle it, and it will be called Glenfarclas if they bottle it. So they will sort a custom label out for you because you've seen all these custom Glenfarclas labels for different clubs, different shops, there's some RAF squadron type labels I've seen around that come up at auction different times. And if they bottle it, that's their rule. It's their distillery. It's their rules. You know, it's their house that you're playing with. And so they will bottle it for you. But if you buy a cask and bottle it yourself, they do not want that Glenfarclas name on there because that's their branding and that's what they want to protect. You can make hints of what it is because, you know, they wouldn't sell you a load of old rubbish because it would be more than their reputation is worth. So, they don't sell rubbish. But you're just not allowed to name it. That's their brand. That's their trademark, Glenfarclas. So you can make little references to the location, the red door or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think that opens up such opportunity for fun because the distilleries have control of whether their product's nameable when they sell it on because of the paperwork. They can control the paperwork and they can come after you if they don't like it for other reasons after that. But I think Bootiki, I remember in 2010 is when I was at Maltstock with Ben, one of the founders of Master of Malt and of this of Bootiki, and the ideas came to them because this is an event that you're camped out at a Boy Scout thing with a bunch of whiskey nerds, geeking out, telling stories, and it was a way to tell stories in a fun way because whiskey can get pretty snobby, and there weren't illustrated labels, things where there was always a certain type of font and very serious labels and traditional aesthetic. And I think they saw an opportunity to appeal to a whole new whiskey lover who would engage in a different way. And I think Dave deals with that every day when he's talking about Bootiki. When you're unpacking a label or looking what Emily did, there's a story there. Sometimes they're personal and sometimes they're related to the distillery and sometimes they're bullshit. But the main thing is they're fun. Whiskey should be fun.
Do you think that whiskey generally is too traditional? Are the labels a bit too similar, a bit too one-dimensional?
Well, we're lucky that right now we have a global palette to select from. We have a global world, a whole world of whiskey. Any country that was buying barley spirit matured from Scotland and buying bottles, drinking single malt or drinking blended scotch, they're now making it. And they don't have to adhere to the old school rules. Now, maybe they will on their labels, you know, of New Zealand distilleries because that cue, the quality cue of scotch is still so powerful. But I mean, using New Zealand as an example or any country around the world, there are many examples in these countries that just throw that out the window and say, no, we're going to use see-through turquoise hazed glass or we're going to use bags. We're not going to use bottles at all or whatever. There's a lot, there's so much room, so much further to go, but we're already on that path, I think. But yes, I think we shouldn't be too quick to criticize, you know, or the singularity of Scotch and that how the labels all look similar, because that's part of what's enshrined it in this premium category is being clear to us what's quality. And that's probably another reason why we, with Boutique-y, an 800-pound Boutique-y, a 1,000-pound Boutique-y doesn't necessarily appeal to everyone, because someone who wants to spend £1,000 on a bottle maybe doesn't like an illustrated label. You know, and that's cool. That's fine.
You are seeing a lot more illustrated labels starting to, you see a lot more illustrated labels coming onto the market now with both brands and independent bottlers. There's a lot more fun coming back into the labels. A lot of distilleries are working with artists and having a series of whiskies with slightly differently illustrated labels and cartons, which is kind of cool as well.
And now Boutique-y's really kind of expanded though to become a independent bottler of rum and gin as well. And, you know, within whiskey as well, you cover quite a broad church of different styles of whiskey, don't you?
Right from the start in whiskey, we knew that there was a huge market out there of people making great whiskey right around the world. So it's something that we wanted to get, into. And it also allows us to bring, you know, these Australian whiskies that we've just recently bottled. No one over this side of the world has heard of a lot of these distilleries. We hear of Australian whiskey doing great, winning awards, but you could never get hold of any. So it was one way we could bring some Australian whiskey over here for people in the UK and Europe to actually taste something, because not a lot of the Australian whiskey does find its way outside of Australia. I mean, we bottled some Overeem a long time ago, just when Overeem was pushing into the UK after 2014, when Sullivan's Cove won the world's best whiskey. Was it 2014?
Yes, yeah, it was the first
Sullivan's
one.
Sullivan's Cove. Yeah. Everyone was raving about Australian whiskey, but you just couldn't find any. And then the Overeem guys came over, and there was a small company over here tasted it. Wow, this is incredible stuff. Well, let's bring it to the UK. It was very difficult to find over here. And we managed to get a couple of casks out of Overeem, and they were very, very well received. Bottlings have disappeared quite quickly. You don't see an awful lot of these smaller distilleries over here. You know, Starwood have been making great strides in UK and Europe, you know, really pushing the brand and pushing Australian whiskey, like spearheading the invasion. That's really cool, because, you know, the palette of flavors that the global whiskey industry can give is, you know, they're not trying to copy Scotch. They are putting their own local stamp onto it, which is really kind of cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Boutique-y was never about being limited to Scotch. I don't think, even from the beginning, I think the ambition was always find great juice that might be whiskey, that might be gin, that might be rum, put it in a bottle in a fun new way I think that's always been the intention.
You opened the account with some pretty spectacularly rare whiskies, from what Dave was saying earlier on.
Yeah, we wanted to enter the market with a bit of a boom. Yeah. we've bottled whiskey from right around the world. But, you know, yeah, we're huge fans of Scotch whiskey. You know, I always go on about their 95 established single malt distilleries in Scotland. That's everything older than Kilhoman. And out of those 97, to date, we bottled 77 of them. So there's still a few more that I want to get. And, I do make these little hints to our cask buyer regularly. We bottled two of the new distilleries already. So Nicnean and another one, which remained nameless, but it was a big distillery that we had to bottle as a teaspoon malt, a blended malt. We bottled two of the new ones, and we're hoping to get a few more of those new ones. We bottled six of the operating grain distilleries in Scotland, so there are seven operating. But what's really cool, as a geek like me, we bottled all seven of the closed grain distilleries. So those distilleries were closed from 1983 up to 2010, I think Port Dundas closed, but all set, we covered all of those. Even those ones that had so little output north of Scotland, I mean, they were only around for 21, 22 years, the north of Scotland distillery. and the Garn Heath. I think they were just a little bit shorter. 20 years they were around for. So, yeah, whiskies are rare as rock and all shit, really. Just to be able to have a bottle or two of those is really, yeah, as a geek, just to tick, yeah, we've done one of them. But, you know, right around the world, wherever I'm, when travel was back, when I was out at whiskey shows, and you're meeting these distillers from all around the world, and you're talking to them about finding out what they're doing, and then you taste what they've got on the stand that day and think, bloody hell, this is brilliant. Would you be interested in working with us? I mean, that's 291 Distillery Rye from our last series at Bottled. You know, that story of that rye, I met the distiller while judging at the World Whiskies Awards. We'd been judging all morning. We went to the pub afterwards for a Guinness with everyone. Then we ended up in Black Rock in London, talking, drinking cocktails. He pulls out this hip flask and hands it to me, and I took a sip of it and thought, that's the best thing I've tasted all day. You know, I said, we need to talk. And within weeks, we'd had samples shipped back from Colorado. And then we worked out how we were going to bottle it and, you know, the label design and all of that. But yeah, just superb stuff. Whiskey from right around the world.
I'm not sure if everyone believes that, though, Dave. And I think it's an important story, James, if we can just elaborate on it. Because I think with our current relationships with distillers, new distillers in Scotland, distillers around the world, it's personal. It's not just business or commercial or contractual. It really is that there's a whiskey community, a global whiskey community. And we're able to secure casks because of it. It's really cool. I mean, yes, there's this old tradition of brokers in Scotland, and there's a secondary market of casks circulating, and then there's investor-grade shit screwing everything up. But generally, it's humans talking to other humans and saying, yeah, I'd love to work with you. And that's a really cool thing about being an independent bottlers. We're not loyal to one distillery or one brand other than the brand whiskey with an EY or a Y at the end. That's our brand.
And from the point of view of a consumer, when like a lot of the distilleries that you have bottled would have plenty of other bottlings readily available in the market, what's the argument for wanting to buy from an independent bottler?
Oh, don't get me wrong, I buy both whiskies all the time, you know, brand whiskies and independent bottled whiskies all the time. I mean, it's not something that I'm not going to buy anything from the brand, because there are bottled, yeah. The brands are great, but an independent bottler will give you something slightly different. Yeah. Most independent bottlers, all independent bottlers, if they're in business still, they're passionate about great whiskey. Simple as that. You know, they're geeks. it is a labor of love. They love what they do. I've never met an industry or people in an industry, anything like the whiskey industry, where everybody loves what they're making. You know, you go to a distillery that hasn't got a brand, you know, these distilleries that feed blending houses effectively, they haven't got their own brand. But the people there are absolutely passionate about, they're making the best whiskey, and it should have a brand. And they love their Linkwood, their Glenlossies, their Dalhuans, you know, those sort of, the passion within the industry is what draws people in, I think. You said it when we met last time about when you met people in the drinks industry. The passion behind the drinks industry. It's a leisure product. People are very passionate about what they're making and what they're putting into bottles, whether it's whiskey, whether it's wine, whether it's gin, they're passionate about it.
And some of the bottlings that you guys have been talking about, they're very much collector's items, quite expensive. Is there an attempt to sort of strike a balance with boutique-y of also having some more accessible offerings as well?
I'm pretty sure, and I think it's safe to say from the beginning, any boutique that's been bottled has been intended to be opened and consumed. So nothing's been priced or packaged to be put in the shelf and stored for an investment for your great-grandkids. Although we do that, of course, because, you know, we find a bottle we like, we all do that. But I don't think that's ever been the intention. The intention is, holy shit, you need to try this. That's what I mean, I've known Ben, like I said, for 10 years. I've only been at the company for 3 years, but I know that's the attitude of a whiskey lover is, you got to try this. And that's what informs our decisions with boutique. If you taste a cask of Mortlach, or you taste a cask of Bakery Hill, and it immediately you want to call a friend over and be like, you got to try this, or send a sample to someone, that's the sign we should bottle it. So the whiskey is a drink, you know, primarily. So I hope it's safe to say, Dave, because I've only been here for 3 years, but since I've been here, we've never packaged anything for any target except for getting it poured into a glass and consumed.
Yeah, well, that was the original intention right from the start. It was about opening your bottles and drinking it, some of these rarer, old Port Ellens, old Capadonics. No, they're not. Port Ellens especially, and certainly the older Macallans these days. I mean, they're not cheap, but we bottle it and package it, so it's not really collectible. It's in it's just in a 500ml bottle with a fancy label on it, and no box, no wooden box, no decanter or anything like that. It's meant to be just popped and enjoyed.
But on that point, though, James, I hear you, man. Like, I think independent bottlers generally are more expensive than entry-level own label or proprietary whiskeys, you know, because they've owned the cask from birth. They know the expense, and they're building it up from there. For us, sometimes we're coming into a cask of Port Ellen that's already exchanged hands 3 times. It's going to be expensive to us. So, of course, that expense is passed on when we try to sell it. But, you know, we are closer and closer than I think we've ever been to direct from the distillery, as we were with this Australia series, as we are with a lot of our suppliers around Scotland and around the world, the US as well. So those costs are down. And then, yeah, the average boutique cost does come down, but we're certainly, we're not greedy with margin. We're not greedy with wasting money on packaging. We're happy to pay Emily for her work very fairly, and it should be so. And beyond that, yeah, which we do always endeavor to get things that are at a price that people can afford. And look, I think that's part of why they did 50 CL to begin with. I know it frustrates some people, but when you do the math and multiply the price of a 50 CL to the large size, it's still usually below where it might be for some comparable. I know I recently saw a Kalila from another independent bottler that was a 9-year-old Kalila that was 110 pounds. And people complained about our Kalila at 65 pounds from a sherry cask. Well, we're still cheaper when you do that, when you scale up to the 700. But I think the 50 CL, the 500 ml bottle, was always about making it a little easier to even get a taste of it. And, you know, in the States, we do 375s, we've done 200s, we have drinks by the dram. It's always been about, again, trying to share and enjoy and try to get other people to share that experience with you. So, I think that the proof of that is also just in the packaging. It's 50 CL trying to get that price lower. So some people can make it more accessible. Well, I guess World Whiskey Blend would fall into that category too, Dave, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, World Whiskey Blend was about really having something that we can repeat, because none of our batches are repeatable. They are 1, 2, 3 casks. We never say single cask. We never say cask strength. Some of them are, some of them aren't, but it's never important to us. What's important is the quality of the liquid in the bottle. Now, the World Whiskey Blend allows us to create a blend of whiskies from right around the globe, allow Sam to practice his blending skills.
He needs lots of practice.
There's been lots of practice. There's lots of practice, lots of sipping and supping to make sure it's just right. But you know, most people around the world aren't geeks like us with a Glencairn. I've just put it away. Most people drink whiskey in a rocks glass or a tumbler with ice and a mixer. And, 90% of the world's Scotch whiskey is still blended Scotch. I know that number is slowly falling. It's probably something like around 88 today. They're not geeks like us. They drink whiskey because they enjoy it. And it's bottle on the table, bucket of ice, bottle of Coke, a bottle of soda maybe, depending where you are. In the Far East, it is always Coke and soda on the table with a bucket of ice and a bottle of whiskey. And it didn't matter whether it was a Scotch whiskey or a Thai whiskey. But that's how it was drunk, in tall glasses, ice, and the cork came out or the top came off and it never went back on, basically. You sat down with friends and you put the words to right. So that's what we wanted with Boutique Gear. It was just a way to get more people enjoying whiskey.
Let's talk about the Australian series then. Tell me about how this eventuated. Who got excited about Australian whiskey and conceived the idea?
I think we're all excited about Australian whiskey, aren't we, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're frustrated. Like Dave said, it's so frustrating living in this part of the world and not being able to get it. I went to Australia when I worked with Balvenie, and I insisted every bar I went to, show me something cool from Australia. So I think our cask buyer, Felix, visited. We'd been in touch with Australian distillers already. I already knew David Vitale because when I was over there with David Stewart with Balvenie, he made efforts to come find us any opportunity and spend time with David and pick his brain, which is a good use of time for sure. But yeah, I mean, the community, again, the distiller community, the beer community, the wine community in Australia is pretty strong. So there really was that sense immediately. And then, so yeah, Felix, our cask buyer, went over to Australia and visited people and came back with stories of, you know, Gareth and Angela and Brian and Janice and all these awesome stories, these personalities, these people that I just can't wait to spend time with. And we've spoken to them on Zoom calls, but really can't wait to spend time with them. Anyway, the whiskeys he brought back, the samples he brought back, I'd spent a day, maybe this is me fucking up with my memory, but tasting Mortlocks and Old Strath Islas and some really sexy Scotch whiskeys one day. And the next day, or it might've been the next week, I don't know. But anyway, the next time I was in the lab, Felix came in with samples from his trip to Australia. And some of these 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old whiskeys from Australia blew those 30-year-old Scotch whiskeys out of the water for complexity, for individuality, for character, for mouthfeel. And you could just feel like this is the direction of whiskey, of grain-based spirits generally. It was really an exciting thing. We got to do this. We got to make a plan and bottle as much of this as we can because now is the time. The 21st century might be the century of Australian whiskey.
Was there anything you were seeing across all of those whiskies that you tried and across the whiskies that you've selected in this series that was universal across all of them that was kind of showing, you know, the origins of an Australian style? Or were they all very contrasting?
That is such a you question. Now, I haven't listened to you forever. I haven't heard all your podcasts, but God, that is so you. Yeah, have you passed that to wine people? And okay, all right.
Oh, really? Have I? I don't know. I don't even remember that.
Oh, yes.
I guess we hear a lot about the wine industry here. We've got access to a lot of unique wine casks that would be very different to what people have in the rest of the world. So that's obviously one really obvious thing that probably separates Australian whiskey to other markets.
What we really noticed was the passion that, certainly what Felix picked up, it's all about personality. It's back to back, the passion that these people have for making their whiskies in a little distillery that's not much bigger than a double garage over here. You know, it's a husband and wife team. It's a one-man band who decides, well, I've got a problem, I'll make it. No, I'll just make it. I know how to make one of them. I can make a still in the yard. I can make a malting machine. Yeah, I think I can do that out of an old laundrette tumble dryer and some, yeah, that sort of thing. I'm just going to get
Peter Bignall, right? That one.
Yeah.
Chip shop oil.
I've got far too much. I've got a huge rye harvest this year. What am I going to do with it? Yeah, let's make a distillery. I think the Australian style is just get on and do it.
Yeah, I don't know what passion tastes like, Dave, but I agree with you. Because I think, James, I've struggled to answer the question, is there a single characteristic objectively in the liquid itself? No, probably not. But being struck by every glass is part of it, though. Being so individually like, whoa, what's that? And then you need to find out more. That's if there's any signature for the style of Australian whiskey right now, I would say it's that. It's being so individual and so striking for it being its own thing. And then when you delve further to get a further story, you end up with a character like Peter Bignall. You end up with these husband and wife teams, or you end up with the daughter of the godfather of Aussie whiskey. It's just really, there's so much going on. And I think having grown out of an agrarian tradition in Scotland, you know, all over the world though, you know, making spirits, making wine, it's a farming tradition. Taking that attitude, exactly as Dave said, let's have a bash. Maybe you can taste that. And I think that attitude is fucking exciting and puts a fire under the ass of the old world distilleries too, because a little bit of that is a lot of fun.
You were telling me last week about, you know, the scale of some of these distilleries and how, you know, what percentage you've managed to get hold of their annual production. It's quite remarkable.
There's one example. It was a Tinchhead, Dave. What's the example where it's like?
I think it might have been Blackgate.
It's Blackgate.
That's from memory. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. The casks that we took represented 4% of their annual production. Yeah.
How cool and how generous. Thank you very much again. I mean, that's really cool though. It gives them a chance to get on lips around the world because boutique can be distributed everywhere. And it gives us a chance to put something really cool from a really cool producer in a bottle.
And then probably at the other end, you've got Starwood. So there's sort of quite an array of, you know, and I suppose Starwood, you know, by Australian standards, they're massive, but, you know, in terms of a Scotch whiskey scale, not that big, really. So But within an Australian context, quite an array of different size distilleries that all have really different stories.
Yeah, Starwood had to be in our lineup. We had definitely something that we wanted in our lineup because A, they're very well known over here. It's the only real Australian brand that you're seeing over here regularly. The other one, little ones come and go. Everyone's heard of Lark because of Bill. Yeah, Starwood wanted, we wanted Starwood in the lineup. And fortunately, they said yes.
Yeah. Well, and let's be clear too, in Scotch whiskey, Glenfiddich, Glenlivet, these are the big names that pushed into new markets around the world. And today they're seen as like four-letter words, but they're some of the best distilleries in Scotland. Just because they're everywhere, it doesn't mean they're shit. And I think Starwood's done a great thing for pioneering a path for so many others to be able to follow. Maybe they'll never scale up, but I know Archie Rose is ready to scale up. I know there's many examples of great distilleries in Australia that because of Starwood's ability to push forward and get that story out there and pique interest amongst nerds like us, but even wider, that's helping the wider industry the same way that first movers like Glenfiddich and Glenlivet did, the Pullman Railway across the US or wherever Glenlivet went, and then Glenfiddich as a single malt globally.
Well, guys, tell us about, you know, where we can find these whiskies and what's the damage? What are they going to set us back?
Well, you know, look, man, you know Australian whiskey is not cheap, right? Australian whiskey isn't cheap.
Yes,
but it's fair to say right. Craft whiskey around the world generally isn't cheap because the real, like, the economies of scale aren't in place. If you're a husband and wife team and it's just part of your farming cycle in the year, you're not producing a lot. You're subject to seasons and to, you know, grain harvest and all these other things. The cost per liter to make it is way higher than North British or, you know, one of these, a grain distillery in Scotland. So I think what's the spread of prices, Dave? It's like 60 to 150?
I think the highest one is the Calara, which is about £170 a bottle over here. The press release came out. I think the cheapest one is around £50-60, which would be the Starwood because it's on the economy of scale.
And when you say global, which other markets are there that it's going into other than the UK and Australia? And, you know, presumably you feel like there's genuine interest in Australian whiskey in those other countries.
I think we have the problem that we can't supply the demand, which is a great boutique-y issue. There's more people that wanted it who couldn't get it because, you know, the small casks, or we just had one cask of this, one cask of that. But no, we sold into Poland, all over Europe, France, all over Europe. But real appetites, like they wanted more than we were able to give them because we wanted to be able to spread it out as much as possible. Australia, obviously, New Zealand, Asia, all across Asia. But again, because some of these outturns were quite small, it's like a few bottles here and there. So it's been great. It's been a really great response. And again, cool to be able to tell that Australian story in a boutique-y independent bottle way, really globally, everywhere. Even if it's a few cases, it's still really exciting to be able to do that and be in Singapore and be in all over the world.
Yeah, and putting a whole flight together as a series is rather than just one release sneaked in, to have a little fanfare about Australian whiskey is really kind of cool. So these themed releases that we've been trying to do, well, we started middle of last year with our World Series. We put a whole group of world whiskeys together and went into a rye series. To have an Australian series, just a lineup of seven malts and one rye, it's nice to have a whole flight to talk about.
Well, guys, I'm really excited to taste the whiskies, and I think it's great that Boutique is showing this level of confidence in Australian whiskey. Thanks so much for joining me for a chat. It's been great fun.
Hey, man, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, and hope to get to see you in real life soon.
One of these days. One of these days.
That was our plan all along, Dave, wasn't it? We were only doing these whiskies so we'd have an excuse to go to Australia again. I love Australia.
Just for the junket.
Doing these global series just to travel the world. Yeah, let's... Where have we? We haven't been to Tibet.
Let's do Thailand. Yeah, yeah. Tibetan whiskey.
Yeah, yeah. And all you get is a fucking Zoom call.
Yeah.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.